Chapter 24. Night came, our first on Ararat. The clouds that had been gathering solidified into a storm, pouring continuous sheets of rain onto the island. Lightning shattered the sky, sometimes striking near enough to light the remains of first camp in a spasm of counterfeit day. The sea swelled in slow, dark, green-crested waves, like the breathing rhythms of some world-wrapping monster. Something enormous, black, tentacular, and foul-tempered, that we were in abject danger of rousing. We returned to the warmth and security of Scythe, where nothing of the storm touched us. Although all three of us had visited Ararat before, even if I remembered almost no part of my time here, Glass was still insistent that we should be subjected to thorough examinations in case something had changed in the biological environment of the planet. But if anything harmful had got into us, it was too subtle to be picked up by Glass's methods. Beyond runny noses and mildly irritated eyes, neither of which were expected to last, we were experiencing no ill effects directly attributable to Ararat. Before we rested, Pinky and I went to the hibernation bay and made a revised inventory of the sleepers, according to physical fitness and age. Barras, and probably Rose, had already been agreed upon, but it took some further deliberation to settle on the other 10 to rouse first. We needed pigs who were old enough to work and take decisions independently, but not so infirm that any manual labor was too much for them. If we were too slow in establishing a settlement, the survivors were going to have to travel with us regardless of any risk that lay ahead. Having made our choices, we set the caskets to a slow revival cycle, knowing it would be at least 13 hours before any of them reached any awareness. We needed sleep ourselves, but before we spoke to the 12, we also needed the ghost of a plan, so that Barras and the rest did not feel they were being thrown to the fates. "Glass is getting worse," I said, while Pinky folded shut the last of the manual override panels on the 12 caskets. "And Glass probably has ears in every part of this ship." "Then she won't be surprised by any part of this conversation. She's pinning her hopes on the jugglers being able to fix whatever went wrong with her in the swine house, winding her back to the version of Glass that visited here the last time. What do you think?" "I think we might be asking a lot of something that no one understands." I dropped my voice in deference to his earlier comment. "But she is getting sicker, and I'm certain we're only seeing the tip of it. You saw how she nearly collapsed out there. If I hadn't caught her, she'd have probably dashed her head on those rocks."
"I'd be more worried about the rocks."
"I'm concerned that we may not have much time now that we're here. As soon as that boat is ready, and this storm dies down to the point where it isn't suicide to go out into the water, I think we ought to be leaving."
"And you want me with you?"
"If Glass is right, things didn't go so well the last time I was here. It may be that I never reached my brother, but it's also possible that I reached him, whatever remains of him in this ocean, and he fought back. I need an advocate, someone whom my brother will recognize as a friend and an ally."
"Then maybe go with someone other than the person who killed him."
"Whatever happened between you and Neville, I know this much just from the time I've spent with you. Whatever you did it with love in your heart." He began to scoff, but I carried on regardless. "The universe gave you no choice. It held your hand in an iron glove and made you do its bidding. And if your hand was on that knife, so was my brother's at every step."
"Maybe it was."
He held a fragile calm for a moment before exploding. "But I still killed him." His mind understood why it had to happen, but that was his living mind. Whatever's left of him out there, the two aren't necessarily the same. What if all that's left of Neville Clavaine is hate and rage and regret, and a faint memory of someone who cut him open while he was still screaming? Then we may need to be each other's advocates.
Is that the best reassurance you've got?
For now.
Well, if it does take madness to go out in that boat, I'd say you've got that part covered.
Pinky gave a dog-like shiver that I took to be equal parts fury and exasperation.
"You fuckers, all of you. Clavaines. Why does my life keep getting tied up in your problems? Why am I always the salvation? Why can't you find some other pig? Look on it this way. We have excellent taste in allies. In the morning, the 12 were revived. Glass, Pinky and I were waiting for them as they came to life, ready to dab lips and eyes and offer succor to dry throats. Scorpio and I bore the brunt of the work, since Glass was having trouble controlling her trembling. They had the obvious questions. Had we made it to Ararat? Where was Lady Arik? Why were the others still sleeping? What was going to happen next? We answered them patiently, imagining ourselves in the same states of ignorance, and were not at all annoyed when our account of skimming bright sun was either dismissed outright or accepted without dispute. Our 12 fell into two camps, it seemed, either knowledgeable enough to think our exploit an outrageous falsehood until we stressed that it had really happened, or sufficiently ignorant of stars and their properties not to consider it in any way remarkable. They were soon disabused of that notion. We explained that the ship had come close to catastrophe, and only Lady Arik's bravery had held it together, but that bravery had taken her from us. The pigs could not mourn her as Pinky and probably Rose did, not even as much as Glass, who had lost a collaborator, if not a friend, but they understood that her absence cost us very dearly. "It's nearly the worst thing that could have happened," I told them, "but the very worst would have been all of us dying, and we have Lady Arik to thank that that's not the case. She's given us a chance to carry on, a chance to regroup and continue our fight, which we will, in her name, and those who gave themselves so that we could escape from the wolves around Epsilon Eridani." I drew myself up, looking each of them in the eye. "Now we need to work, without her guidance, and we do have work ahead of us." When Barras, probably Rose, and the other 10 were fit enough to walk around and leave Scythe, we ventured back onto land. The worst of the storm had played out overnight, with rain only falling in spurts, and never as heavily as it had at its fiercest. That did not mean that the weather was treating us kindly. The sea was still wind-ruffled and restless, and more clouds were marshalling to the northeast. It was not exactly how I might have wished to present this new world to the refugees, but I supposed it was better they were acquainted with its moods now than be disheartened later on. Yet the 12 seemed unconcerned. It was a wonder to them just to be able to breathe outside, or walk more than a few strides without running into cage bars or a wall. They tripped, stumbled, fell face down on the slippery rocks, and got up laughing again. There would be many bruises and gashes by the time the day was done, many stinging eyes and runny noses, perhaps an aching bone or two, but all seemed to consider the price of survival a fair one. Even probably Rose, who had never been incarcerated, was glad to be somewhere not bounded by artificial surfaces, and where her life did not depend on the immediate and continual functioning of machines. "We can live here," she said to me, gesturing at the conch structures. "If they did, we can, yes and yes. I know they didn't have it easy, but we've been through worse." "I don't doubt it, and we're not necessarily talking about a place that no one ever leaves, just a world where we have to live for a few decades." I smiled at myself. How easily I spoke of decades as if they were mere inconsequential episodes in a lifetime, soon forgotten. I knew better, but the old habits lingered.
"We, as in, yes, you," probably Rose said.
"Scythe will return." A rash promise, but if I did not bank on success, I might as well have ended myself now. And we may not be the only ship. I'm sure there are others out there, somewhere. If we succeed, then eventually there won't be any need for us to hide. Those of you who've adapted to Ararat can remain, but it doesn't have to be a life sentence.
But first, and verily, we have to build."
The 12 had already been briefed on the burden placed on them. Pinky was there to assist, but it was up to them how they went about the division of labor and responsibility. First, it was agreed that they would explore the conchs and decide which were the most suitable for early occupation. After that, the work would be at least twofold. One group would spend time learning how to collaborate with Scythe,
persuading it to manufacture what they needed. The other group would be preparing the ground, clearing out debris and drawing up blueprints for partitions, floors, and ceilings, interlocking with what was already present, building on the ruins. "Nothing needs to be perfect," I stressed. "It just has to work well enough for now. The ship will remain here while three of us go off in the boat, so there's always that fallback. You can come and go as you please, and depend on the ship for your basic needs. But we always need to be thinking ahead to the day when the ship has to depart, and that may not be too far in the future."
"Months?"
"Sooner, unless things go badly wrong with the pattern jugglers." I watched all the hope drain out of Probably Rose between one breath and the next.
"I take back what I said just now."
The strain of the moment brought on one of her twitching fits, and she cuffed her forehead violently.
"It's yes, yes, and yes, impossible."
"No, just difficult. Every part of this has been done before, and Pinky knows all of it. You'll never starve. Pinky tells me that provided you take certain precautions, you can eat almost anything that washes up against the island. I won't say you won't get bored of it, but it'll keep you alive. And you won't suffocate or die of anything contagious. Nor will you die of hypothermia. Clothes, blankets, and heaters will be easy to provide. This isn't the end. It's the start of something. Ararat is about as compatible a planet as we could ever land on."
"It killed the others."
"No," I stressed. "Not Ararat. And not the pattern jugglers. They were both tolerant hosts. It was the war that happened in space that spelled their end, and it won't come again."
"You're very sure of yourself?"
"There'll be a war," I clarified, "but not the kind we fought before. The next one will be different." She measured me with a gently cocked head.
"You've changed from the man who came to us, the man I stuck my needles into on that first night in the stronghold. Yes and yes. I knew it was you from the genetic samples, but I still didn't believe it, not quite. Now I do. There's another man looking out at me from behind your face. Colder. Harder, yes and yes. More sure of himself. More willing to think the unthinkable."
I didn't ask for this. But now that it's here, I feel like it was always waiting to come back. I stomped my foot onto rock. "We make a stand here. We build something. We build to say that humanity's not done, that we've been pushed back, cornered, forced to cower and hide. But we're not finished. We've been into the darkness, all of us. This is the cusp, the point where we turn to the light again. It starts on Ararat, and it starts with you." She considered my words, nodded slowly.
"So, build."
"So build," I echoed.
"Go and tend your boat, old man,"
Probably Rose told me.
"Some of us have real work to be getting on with. Yes and yes."
Part of me would have been very glad to depart that morning. Not because I was in any way looking forward to meeting the jugglers, but because there could be no room in my thoughts for much else. I had felt the same way on Sun Hollow, when I knew I had to have a tooth taken out. I just wanted it over, to be on the other side of all the pain and uncertainty. But we would not be leaving for a day or two. Glass expected to be ready with the adaptations to the boat by the evening, and the provisioning could be done an hour or two before we were ready to depart. But the weather had other plans for us. The overnight storm might have broken temporarily, but those clouds on the horizon had continued to swell and mass their ranks, and now they looked like dark-bellied galleons. Hulls prickling with cannon fire. The sea roared and spat. A bigger craft with an enclosed cabin could have set out, but our open-topped boat would have been tossed to the waves within minutes of setting sail. It was laughable that it had come to this, that all our travelling, all our boldness, had brought us back to the Stone Age, watching the skies and setting our eyes to the wind. We had no forecasts and no idea of the weather conditions beyond the horizon. Glass had been unwilling to leave monitoring eyes in orbit, and now that we were safely down, she was adamant that it was too much of a risk to send any drones or servitors out on scouting trips beyond first camp, in case they registered with the wolves. It would be dangerous enough setting off in a boat, but that
was the one part of our expedition that could not be avoided. So we had to wait. While it tested my nerves, the delay did at least allow time for Barris and the others to get into their stride, and for Pinky and me to lend our wits and muscles where we could. Scythe and its servitors had been busy, spitting out stacks of simple, modular forms which could be locked together to make chairs and tables, as well as providing the tools and bonding agents to allow these forms to be adapted into more complicated designs. Already the administrative conch contained a long, ramshackle galley, where legs could be rested and food and drink served, and a number of basic partitions had already been established to provide toilets and washrooms, furnished using basic but reliable templates from Scythe's libraries. It was all haphazard to start with, and both the food and waste products had to come and go from the ship. But over time, as Pinky's experience told us, there was nothing to stop the settlement becoming dependent solely on the sea. Knowing that a thing could be made to work was a very powerful incentive to short-term problem-solving, and his assurance and swagger soon communicated itself to the 12. Pinky was also wise enough to step back when he saw a solution, but knew that it would help the 12 to discover it for themselves. I watched him with a powerful sense of pride, as if I had ownership of his accomplishments, and then rebuked myself for that fallacy. By the end of the second full day, when the worst of the eye and nasal irritation had begun to wear off, there was talk of bringing out more of the sleepers to accelerate the preparations. But Barris, and probably Rose, had established the outlines of a democratic process, and the matter was voted on, and narrowly rejected. The 12 would continue building at their own pace, and only revive another portion of the refugees when they had something to show them, besides acres of slimy rock, drafty conchs, and sad moraines of human debris. The 12 worked in shifts, alternating between the physical labor of clearing out the conchs and the mental tasks of learning how to communicate with Scythe. Glass had arranged control interfaces for the ship's manufactory, enabling the pigs to work with natural language, written code, or abstract symbol manipulation. The interfaces were custom-manufactured weatherproof compads, sturdy enough to be dropped on rock or into shallow water, and with their tactile controls suitable for pig digits. None of this was straightforward for the pigs, since few of them had ever had to submit instructions to a machine. But on the other hand, they had almost nothing to unlearn and therefore came to the problem without pre-established ideas. I was pleased to see how quickly they overcame their initial hesitancy and persuaded the ship into creating fully finished objects and machines that already met a need, rather than just raw materials. The process of furnishing the conchs was already gaining pace, and the pigs were coming up with ever more inventive and efficient solutions to help in turning these damp, wind-haunted shells into something livable. It was as if all the years and decades of free will that had been denied them in Yellowstone was now finding expression in a matter of days. Still no bodies had turned up. Glass had found none on her earlier visit, but she had admitted that her search had not been thorough, and I had no sense that I had found bodies either. Although in that respect all I could go on was the emotional tenor of my still-buried memories. There was drowning in there, and fear, but nothing like the horror of coming across unburied dead. Perhaps I, too, had spent only the minimum time in and around First Camp, with all my significant experiences confined to the open waters. I told Glass that I should like to visit the memorial ground she had mentioned before we set off for the jugglers. It felt necessary. A paying of respects. But Glass demurred. What had been an hour's travel in her skimmer would be far more arduous in our boat, and she was against anything that counted as an unnecessary journey.
"This isn't tourism, Clavaine. We didn't come here to sightsee."
"I feel like we're already treading on their bones." Glass's rejection was final.
"The moment the weather cooperates, we leave, but not for the memorial ground."
Her eyes searched me.
"What are you hoping to find? Some fond message from your brother? Some absolution from beyond the grave?"
"If I was here, then perhaps I left a message for myself."
"You didn't," she said flatly. "I'd have found it."
The next day the weather was as bad as the first storm, and there was no easing in it for another 52 hours. It made any sort of work difficult, so even the pigs had to slow their labours. They had put down meandering, high-friction walkways around and between the conks, another of the things they had asked Scythe to manufacture. But between the rain, the wind, and the eye-stinging foam flecking in from the sea, it was impossible for any sort of productive labour to go on. The pigs rested, either back on the ship or in the conk where the work was already most advanced. It was a time for wounds to be addressed, sprains and strains to be eased, bellies replenished, stories told and boasts exaggerated. They had heating, and as much hot water as they needed by then, and the ship had no trouble providing food and drink in the desired quantities and varieties. Pinky, in a spirit of solidarity, had even shown the pigs how best to collect, prepare and consume the seaweed, which varieties to look for, which to avoid, and how best to make it semi-palatable. It seemed like the basis for a crushingly monotonous diet, and perhaps it was. But I thought of the similar lessons we had endured on Sun Hollow, though they had happened to some man who was not quite me, and how our palates had gradually found a way to detect surprising nuance and variety in the few basic foodstuffs we had been able to grow in those caverns, and how that discriminatory faculty had only been amplified with each successive generation. The weather did break in the end, although we dared not jump at the first easing of it, in case there was worse to come just over the horizon. But after another day the rains and winds had passed, the skies had cleared to the limit of vision, and the sea had settled into a blue-green torpor, barely marred by a wave. The air became warmer and drier, and by evening the stars overhead were as bright and unwavering as if they were lanterns, lowered by watchful gods. We all observed them with the same thought. Somewhere in the darkness between those lit motes lay our enemy, and perhaps closer to hand than we might wish. But for now, we were powerless against the wolves, and we all pushed them to the backs of our minds as well as we could. Glass's boat was ready. The hull was much as we had found it. To power the boat, Scythe had provided an outboard propulsion system based around three of the shipboard servitors. Their spheres were joined in a row, with a framework around them. They ingested air and accelerated it within themselves, the second and third spheres boosting the output of the one before them before blasting it out as a cold, high-velocity jet. The thrust was enough to move the boat across water at about 40 kilometers per hour, less if there was wind resistance or rough seas. It was barely faster than one of the electric carts we had in Sun Hollow, but it would suit our purposes. The line of spheres was attached to the rear of the boat by a swiveling mounting, and a manual tiller could be worked by someone seated on the last cross-plank. Glass had neural control of the power output, but there were manual inputs built into the tiller for lesser mortals. Nothing in Ararat could be guaranteed against erosion by the sea's biochemical and molecular agents, but at least our motor was not immersed in water, which ought to extend its lifetime long enough to get us to the pattern jugglers and back. At the time of our landing, Glass had determined the nearest large juggler mass as lying 220 kilometers from first camp. If it had not moved, and the sea conditions remained in our favor, we could be there in under 6 hours. Contact with the jugglers did not happen on any sort of predictable schedule, but if we were rebuffed, it was likely to be over with fairly quickly. At this latitude and time of year, bright sun was above the horizon for around 18 hours. There was at least a chance of making a first bid and returning to base before nightfall, and while traveling at night would be riskier, Glass ought to be able to handle the navigation. We agreed to set off just before first light. Although we expected to be back before nightfall, we still made preparations for a longer expedition. We took 3 days' worth of food and water, medical supplies, additional clothing, buoyancy aids, and a sunscreen which could be strung over the boat should we end up becalmed under warm skies. We also took 2 pairs of oars, found in the debris and stowed under the cross planks until we needed them. We brought knives and 1 gas-powered harpoon, but no other weapons. A radio frequency communicator allowed us to remain in touch with probably Rose, although we would limit its use to the minimum. According to Glass, any sort of energy emission was likely to deter the jugglers.
We could not avoid using an engine, but the less of our technological culture we brought with us, the better our chances. Bass and I were already in the boat, settling in and rearranging the stores, when Pinky, Barris, and probably Rose came alongside.
"He says you need him for this,"
Barris said.
"I do." "Bring him back,"
probably Rose said, underlining this imperative with a cyclopean glare.
"He doesn't think we need his help, but we do, yes, yes, yes."
She flicked the back of her hand against her forehead.
"Bring him back, yes, yes."
"We're all coming back," I said, and then wished that I had not, because it sounded like empty bravado. "But we'll take particularly good care of Scorp. He doesn't need to be here. I've asked him along because I need a friend, and I think his presence will improve our chances. But he knows he could walk away, and I wouldn't force him to join us."
"I might," Glass muttered.
Barris helped Pinky with a difficult stride into the boat, while I assisted from the other side.
"You've decided you can't live without my sparkling company, Glass?"
Pinky asked, grunting as he planted his feet on one of the few open spaces between the cross-planks.
"I've decided Clavaine might be right about your usefulness."
She lifted her face to the two figures still on dry land. "We're not likely to be back before at least 13 hours have passed. Don't become too concerned if we're a lot later than that.
Signal us if you... Yes, yes. Signal if you... Yes. Signal if you run into... Yes, difficulties. Yes, yes." "Do you think you'd be able to help us? With no boat and no other means of crossing open water?"
"We'd still want to, yes. Still want to know, yes, yes, and verily."
"You think you would,"
Glass answered. Pinky tucked himself low on the middle cross-plank. Glass was at the back, with the motor and tiller. I was at the front. Without a word from Glass, we began to move, sluggishly at first, because seaweed had already begun to cloy itself around the hull. But then, with gathering speed as the boat knifed out of the seaweed and forged into the relatively open and calm waters beyond the rocks, the motor made a thin, keening whistle, and the turbulence from its jet ruffled the water about 10 meters behind us. Glass increased our speed to what I took to be the boat's maximum. Wind and spray lashed my face, and I soon averted my gaze from the direction of travel, leaving Glass to worry about navigating. We were heading west, with bright sun at our backs. For the first half hour there were reference points to measure our progress, as first camp gradually fell away, and the conch structures became smaller and smaller, until the land they were on dipped beneath the sun-hazed horizon, and finally the tips of the structures vanished as well. After that, and with no other islands near enough to be visible, we were just a small moving point in the ocean, and progress became harder to gauge. The storm was gone, but the sea was choppier than it had looked when we set out, and the crisscrossing patterns of the waves confused my sense of motion. The boat had settled into a semi-regular bumping rhythm, the prow pitching up, since most of the weight was near the bank. Sometimes the waves grew large enough for the boat to steepen against their swell. At other times we cut through them in a slap of stinging spray. We had said nothing since departure. Glass was steady enough now and focused on the job of guiding the boat, but I wondered at the reserves she was drawing on to hold herself together. Pinky was stoic, snout held to the wind, eyes pink-slitted and fixed on the southwesterly horizon. The fine white hairs on his brow were flattened against his skin. "All right?" I asked after the first hour, when I had begun to swallow down the first hints of motion sickness.
"This isn't my first boat trip.
This might be mine. I suppose I must have crossed water to reach the jugglers before, but I don't remember any part of the journey. The last time you were in a boat, was it here?" "Not much call for boats on Gila." He squinted at me. "Got any other topics? Especially ones that don't involve boats and Ararat?" I smiled once. "I'm sorry. I know how hard this must be for you."
"You don't know half of it.
You remember what happened on this planet, and you don't want to revisit it." "I don't remember what happened to me, except that it left me with an aftertaste of fear and drowning. But I have to revisit it. Perhaps this will help us both." Glass watched us silently. It was hard to tell how much she was listening, or indeed, if she cared.
And if it doesn't help us, let's hope it doesn't leave us even more fucked up than we already are. You'd better be ready for that, because I've discovered this weird thing where life doesn't always grant us our fondest wishes.
I'm ready. Frightened, but ready.
I also know that the worst thing this ocean will do to me will be a kindness compared to extinction by the wolves.
For once, a valid observation,
Glass commented. So you were listening?
I always listen.
Whether I process is a different matter. Sometimes the noise inside my head is preferable to any human babble. Congratulations, Pinky said, eyeing me. You made it through her threshold. You're less annoying than white noise. But he paused, still regarding me. I know what happened here and what my part in it was. Nothing can change that. I've made my peace with what I did. Get back to me when you've killed your only true friend in the universe, and then maybe we'll talk.
You killed my brother, I said softly. I think that gives me a stake.
Pinky said nothing. Glass kept her hand on the tiller, and the engine's keening note drilled into my soul. Chapter 25. The sea was all that there was, with all reference points long behind us. We were more than 2 hours out from first camp, and the rhythm and sounds of the boat had become lulling enough that my thoughts strayed into the logicless margins of sleep. I kept blinking to keep myself awake. Then I jolted to alertness. About 100 meters off to our port side, I thought I had seen something break the water, surfacing briefly above the waves. Glass was preoccupied with the motor, but Pinky must have caught my twitch as I snapped to life and tried to track the fleeting form. What? It was the first word he had spoken to me since our exchange about my brother's death.
Nothing,
I answered, for the waves had reclaimed whatever it was I might or might not have seen. Then, unwisely, I just thought, you saw something in the water. He was silent for a second or two. Yeah, me too. Not that time, but a couple of minutes ago, and maybe once before that. Glass was paying attention to us now.
You should have spoken.
He swiveled to face her. Did you see it?
No.
Then you wouldn't have taken me seriously. A pig's visual acuity is lacking compared to... Whatever he saw, I saw, I said, leveling my gaze at Glass. There's something else out here besides sea and microorganisms.
Ararat contains no macro-scale ocean forms. The jugglers are the only large organized life form besides the seaweed rafts.
I don't care what your database says this ocean does or doesn't contain, I said, reaching down into the base of the boat to unship the gas-powered harpoon. Something's following us. Maybe more than one something. Could the jugglers have some part of themselves swimming out here alone, detached from the main node? What I saw looked like an animal, Pinky said. Just a glimpse of it, but enough to tell. Big, dark, and powerful.
As big as this boat?
I don't know. Maybe not. I nodded slowly. I couldn't tell either. I'm not even sure if I saw a head or a fin, but it was real and solid, and moving nearly as quickly as us. This wasn't some mass of microorganisms bobbing along the water. What I saw looked like whale skin. I inspected the harpoon gun, having paid it little enough attention when we loaded the boat. It had a barbed projectile loaded into the barrel, with two spares tucked into a slot in the stock. I armed it, drew it close to my body, sighting along the barrel, and realized how comfortable and familiar the weapon felt. Another dark form caught my eye, this time to starboard, and I tracked onto it with a smooth confidence that surprised me. My finger tightened on the trigger, but I did not fire. This one at least was a trick of the light and waves, melting back into green surf.
If the things you saw were real,
Glass began. No if about it, I snapped back.
Then they don't fit any established template for juggler manifestations. The ocean could support other life forms, clearly. It's just that the records say that it doesn't.
Didn't when you were here, I asked, before you chased me to Michaelmas. and that was a long time ago now. I don't even know what the date is anymore, or that it matters, but there's been time for things to happen here. Whatever it was, we don't know that it's dangerous, Pinky said. You want to take that chance after all we've been through? But I lowered the harpoon gun slowly. Glass was the first to see the pattern jugglers. Still guiding the boat, she used her right hand to draw my gaze to a spot on the western horizon. There, she said, her voice flat and matter-of-fact, the leading edge of the node. We had been underway for nearly 7 hours, longer than expected, and proof that the mass had moved or reorganized itself in the days since our approach from space. The swimming forms, whatever they had been, had not returned since our earlier sightings, and I think Glass was still doubtful that they had been real in the first place. Some of that skepticism had lodged inside me as well. Had I really seen something? And if Pinky had been so sure of his sighting, why had he not mentioned it sooner? One thing was certain. The node was real. After 5 minutes, I could see it clearly for myself, without any direction from Glass. It was a low, fixed smudge, like the first hint of a landmass emerging around the world's curvature. It was altering the weather in that direction, conjuring a train of clouds above it, condensing moisture where the air was slightly cooler than out over the open water. I stared at it as we continued our approach, and within a few minutes, Pinky confirmed that he was seeing it as well. The smudge widened, more and more of the mass emerging over the horizon. It was as low as a reef, at least on its margins, but hugely extended to the north and south. Thousands of square kilometers of it still mostly out of sight. Look, I said excitedly, my eye catching movement to the south of us. A flying fish or a bird? No flying fish or birds on Ararat, Glass responded. But she was also watching the fast-fleeting thing as it skimmed the waves. It's a messenger sprite, flying between two nodes, packaged with information at its point of origin, sent off to be received and digested by the recipient node. They send information by other means, including biochemical signals in the water and living transmission cables floating just beneath the surface and extending for hundreds or even thousands of kilometers. But these sprites are what they use when a large packet of information needs to be conveyed very rapidly. Does it mean we've been noticed? Let's not get above ourselves, Clavaine. They've noticed us, most certainly. There's nothing they don't notice. But these information exchanges go on all the time. Think of the nodes as a vast collective bureaucracy, constantly auditing itself. Pinky asked, "What about the other things we saw?" Glass looked at him patiently, irrelevant to our present concerns. Glass reduced our speed as we crossed the last few kilometers between open water and the boundary of the node. The transitions had looked sharp from space, but that had been deceptive. The node spread into the surrounding sea, thinning out, but pushing its influence far beyond the point where it resembled a distinct raft-like mass. The sea was becoming more grey-green, more opaque and more sluggish, carrying a denser cargo of microorganisms. The boat's motion became more ponderous, the motor having to do more work to keep us pushing forward through the thickening resistance. The green mass slipped past our hull on either side. It had a slurry-like texture, but with increasing hints of structure and organization. There were mesh-like patterns and rope-like tubes embedded within it, and as the biomass moved on the remaining swell, it gave the uneasy impression of countering the action of the waves, rather than going along with them. I had been feeling the edges of seasickness before. Now the full force of it rose in my throat and I had to work very hard not to vomit. Our speed reduced to about half our progress in open water. I peeked over the sides, noticing that the green slurry was adhering to the hull, not just in random splotches, but in a deliberate, connected manner, like the crystalline patterns formed by frost on glass. Pinky and I dragged out a pair of oars and used them to flick away the larger concentrations before they took hold. We'll bog down before we ever reach the main part, I said. There's an open channel a little to the south, Glass said, turning the tiller.
If we can't make it directly, we'll back out and circle around.
The boat could not have been making more than a fast walking pace by the time our speed had dropped to its lowest, but at least we were still moving, and by concentrating our efforts with the oars, we kept the visible part of the hull relatively clean. Now we were heading more or less due south, travelling parallel to the node's edge, and hoping to pick up the inlet Glass had seen. I had to trust that she was right. I had no doubt that such channels existed, for I had seen the signs of them from space, cutting back into the node in glinting filigrees of reflected sunlight. The boat pitched forward, sharply enough that I had to grab on to the sides to stop myself tumbling into the bows. We came to a sudden halt, just as surely as if we had run aground. Glass increased the motor, but it made no difference, merely churning the green-scummed water behind us. "I think we've tangled with something," I said, creeping forward to where the nose of the boat was jammed down at an angle, half buried in a ropey green mass, which emerged from the sea on either side of us. "It must be one of those cables you mentioned, Glass, or a bundle of them. It didn't show above the surface until we ran into it. Can you back us out?"
"Get down," she said. "If you don't, the thrust will blow you out of the boat."
Pinky and I crouched low on the cross planks. Glass put the motor into reverse thrust and brought it up through stages of power. The boat surged, trying to free itself, but whatever we were tangled with was refusing to yield.
"It has us," Glass said resignedly.
She eased the engine down.
"There's no choice. We'll have to cut it loose. Use the knives."
I opened the stores box which contained the knives, thinking how much easier things would be if we had brought a Boser pistol or Excimer rifle. I passed a knife to Pinky, and we leaned over the boat on either side of the bow. I was ready to hack away, but caution stilled my hand.
"Glass,
if we do this, aren't we harming the organism? I thought the whole point was not to antagonize it."
"These connections must form and reform all the time," Glass said. "The biomass has to be able to tolerate a certain level of damage due to environmental factors, without necessarily considering itself under attack."
"I hope you're right, and I also hope we ran into these tentacles accidentally, not because the node is warning us off." I nodded at Pinky, indicating that we should coordinate our cutting. "Ready?"
"Ready."
"Glass, wait until I give the signal, then gun the engine. We'll cut what we can and hope to jerk clean of whatever's left underneath the water." We began to cut. The knives were sharp and went through the fibrous green strands with very little resistance, at least to begin with. There were dozens of strands, knotted around each other in complicated fashion, and it almost seemed as if they were becoming hardier the more we worked at them. After a minute, my hand and wrist slathered in green, I paused to inspect the blade's edge. It had already gained a shimmering, olive discoloration. "It's fighting back. Try the engine, Glass." The boat surged back a good meter, straining the remaining tangles, but failed to free itself. The hull had been smooth, with nothing on it that could snag an underwater obstruction, but the fibers were still clinging on tenaciously. Perhaps they were already forming sticky bonds with the craft, striving to begin the slow but inevitable process of chemical breakdown and digestion. "We'll have to work faster," I said, as Glass eased the motor. "We don't have too much time before these knives give out."
"Should have kept Neville's knife," Pinky said. "That'd go through anything."
I doubted that we had hacked our way through more than half of the entanglement. What remained was harder to reach, even at full stretch, and there might be far more of it underwater than I imagined. When we seemed to have made more progress, I made a motion to Glass, and she gave the engine all it could take. The blast warmed my neck, and we struggled back, and then jerked free, at least temporarily, while still dragging a mass of entanglement with us. Our speed increased, still in reverse. I saw it, then, about 20 meters north of our moving position. A form had broken the green-scummed water, a rounded, hairless head blending into muscular shoulders. Reaching the green carpet next to the gleaming form was a spiked implement, a shaft festooned with green ribbons which trailed back into the water. Instinctively, I looked to the south,
sweeping the green slurry until I picked out the counterpart to the other form. They were about 40 meters apart, swimming humanoids, each holding a similar spiked implement, with a net-like trap stretched between them. I tossed the blunted knife back into the bottom of the boat and took up the harpoon gun again. I leveled it at what I judged to be the easier of the two targets, the one to the north, and fired. The gun coughed, expelling the harpoon with a single explosive gas discharge. I watched the projectile arc over the water, deploying further barbs and extending its range with a secondary gas thruster of its own. My aim had been true, and the harpoon swift, but the swimmer pulled beneath the water in the instant before impact, and there was no way to judge whether I had hit it. I began to retract the harpoon, using the manual winching handle built into the side of the gun. I had only turned it a few times when the line went slack, and I knew instantly it had been severed. Rather than reel in the useless filament, I ejected the entire spool and loaded one of the two remaining barbs from the stock. Glass kept us powering in reverse. Pinky was still hacking away at the remaining green threads adhering to the bow. At last, the bulk of them seemed to slough away, and Glass reversed the boat's thrust and took us on a looping course further to the south. For now, both swimming forms had disappeared. "Well, Glass," I said. Pinky scraped his knife against the hull. "Well, indeed. Would you like to offer an opinion on what the hell those things are?"
"I have nothing to offer."
"Have you seen anything like those creatures before?"
"No,"
she answered with uncharacteristic hesitancy.
"Not here. Not anywhere.
Clearly they are derived from human gene stock."
"Clearly," I echoed.
"You did well, Clavain. I took their intentions to be hostile."
"Laying a net is not generally the best way to open friendly negotiations."
I set down the harpoon gun. "I don't think I killed it. I also don't think I want to run into any more of those until we've completed our business here. Maybe they're just defending their territory, but I'm not much in the mood for politics."
"Everything is politics in the end,"
Glass said. With a surge, the boat pushed through into clearer, less obstructed water. Glass turned hard to starboard, and we advanced along a passage where the green growth was hardly more than a surface dusting, offering minimal resistance. Banks of thicker green marked the channel's boundaries, hemming us in and guiding our course. As we progressed, so these banks became more steeply sided and higher. First 50 centimeters, then a meter, and then high enough that we could not see over the top, either to the south or north. My motion sickness was easing now, as the channel was waveless, but replacing it was a growing sense of claustrophobic encroachment. As the banks rose higher, and the channel narrowed, meandering its way into ever-rising green, I felt the age-old apprehension of the wanderer straying into the darkening forest, unsure of the secrets and terrors it held. I looked back, wondering if any of the swimming forms were likely to follow us. Glass reduced our speed to about 20 kilometers per hour, then further still. The boat's wake was slapping off the green walls, and the turbulence from the motor was stirring patterns into them. "Should we think about rowing?" I asked. "I know we'll be slower, but this is starting to feel impolite."
"We're nowhere near enough to the core,"
Glass said.
"Caution is a good thing, Clavain, but too much of it will kill you."
"Too much of anything will kill you. That's the definition of too much."
"Caution or otherwise," Pinky said, "I'm not liking the look of that." I followed the line of his gaze. The channel split into two even narrower forks. By now the rising walls on either side of us were house-high in places and leaning inwardly. The two forks went off in divergent directions, but neither was more or less inviting than the other. They were thickening, narrowing corridors of green, with sagging rope-like connections strung between their walls.
"This one,"
Glass said, taking us into the left fork.
"It should be the most direct route to the core, if things haven't changed too much. Don't be alarmed by these cross-connections. They're just to enable the node to communicate with itself.
Think of us as a cell moving through the commissural gap between brain hemispheres.
I'm not sure that helps, Pinky said. We continued down the channel, which stayed relatively constant in width for about a kilometer. I knew what Glass was hoping to find, a lagoon-like enclosure of open water within the node, one of several that had been apparent from space. These lagoons, deliberately maintained by the biomass, were often the best prospect for any swimmers hoping to make contact. They were a sign that the node was at least receptive, even if there could never be any guarantees of success. Glass's likening of the node to the structure of a brain stayed with me. There was still no definite opinion on the matter of whether the pattern juggler nodes were themselves conscious, but the nodes were certainly rich in biological methods of information storage, manipulation, and dissemination. The jugglers stored many different informational forms, from nuggets of pure, discorporeal knowledge to species-specific templates for particular modes of cognition. A person could swim in the jungle waters and have the node's microorganisms rebuild their mind to permit the acquisition of some new gift, such as heightened mathematical insight or the grasping of some long-dead alien language. Such juggler-derived talents tended to be temporary, though. After an interval, sometimes only a matter of hours, the imprinted structures would wither away. Very rarely, the change was enduring enough for the swimmer to accomplish some one-off challenge. Repeat visits to the jugglers were uncommon and rarely successful. It was also said that in the rare instances where the changes were permanent, there was wisdom in being careful what you wished for. What had happened to my brother was not like that. If any part of him still existed, it was because his body had been absorbed into the pattern jugglers. Others had been taken by the pattern jugglers, but it usually only happened after an extended sequence of contact episodes, with ample warning along the way. Those individuals usually understood the risk that they were taking and made a calculation that the potential rewards were worth it. By the time they were taken, the sea's organisms would already have insinuated themselves into their bodies to a high degree, marking them as likely candidates for absorption. My brother, according to those who had known him, had never swum. He had been too fearful of what he would find, or rather, what he would not find. The sea had already taken something precious from him. Felka was a child of the conjoiners, and for Neville she was the nearest thing to a daughter. Her mother, in a sense that only conjoiners could understand, had been Galliana, founder of the entire conjoined movement. The inhibitors had killed Galliana. In all likelihood, she had been the first human being to encounter them. But long before her demise, she had visited Ararat, and perhaps left a trace of herself in the ocean. If any human mind could be said to be of interest to the jugglers, it would be the strange and beautiful brain that belonged to Galliana. Felka had been trying to make contact with her mother when the sea swallowed her whole. Neville's grief had been so all-consuming that even hope was a torment. Felka might have transmitted herself into the sea, and through his beloved Felka, he might find a conduit to Galliana. Was it possible that both Felka and Galliana might have left conscious shadows of themselves, even as the medium in which they were stored was itself perhaps less than conscious? But though he shut himself away from his affairs and lived alone by the sea, Neville could never bring himself to take the step into the waters that might have answered all his questions. It had taken death administered by the hand of his oldest and dearest friend, to finally bring him to the sea. To these three lost souls might now be added a fourth, but I had no desire to be taken, just to make contact. The boat scraped deeper into the node. Now the channel was a cloying green corridor with furry walls, and a ceiling made of cross-fretted tendrils, through which bright sun, quite near its zenith, flickered hypnotically with our motion. It was humid and much warmer than it had been out at sea. My nose prickled with a green haze of airborne organisms. Glass brought the engine to a halt. The motor is creating too much disturbance. We'll row from here on in. Excellent idea, I said, fixing my oar onto its mount. Wish I'd thought of it myself.
Pinky and I did the rowing, since I wanted Glass to conserve her energies. Rowing was not really the word for what we did, though. It was more a case of levering the tips of the oars against the resistance of the walls, which were soggy on the surface, and then firmer and firmer the more we pushed in. We were doing well to move at a slow walking pace, and I was soon prickling with sweat. But there was something lulling about the mechanical activity of rowing that helped settle my nerves. Something whirred past my cheek. Startled, I nearly dropped the oar. There was just time to see one of the messenger sprites streaking ahead of us down the green tunnel. Now that the shadows were deeper, it was possible to see that the sprite glowed with bioluminescence. Another came streaking back a few moments later. Then, over our heads, we watched with a dreadful fascination as a pair of green horns extended out from either side, meeting in the middle like the halves of a cantilever bridge. The green tube thickened in throbbing pulses, and I caught a glimmer of colour and movement within it.
"Heightened organizational activity," Glass said, as another pair of sprites fluttered by us. "All this takes energy. There's no doubt that the node is reacting to us, aware of our presence."
"Did this happen to you before?" I caught her hesitation. I think she meant to lie, then decided better of it.
"No, not to this degree. But I wasn't known to the ocean prior to my visit. That is no longer the case for either of us."
"It recognizes us?" I asked.
"Something in it may recognize us."
"Again, not helpful," Pinky said.
A sprite sped down the tunnel, then looped around our boat three times. Now that it was near to us, I had the first opportunity to study it in any sort of detail. It had a bird-sized body, speckled with glowing dots, but no recognizable head or sensory appendages. The only limbs were the whirring wings, fine-veined and translucent. I wondered how it could draw in any information on its surroundings. The sprite broke off from its inspection and zipped away. We kept rowing, moving with the punting rhythm of the oars. The walls were no longer just an organized green slurry with designs on digesting our boat. Now there was a breathing, undulating quality to them, as if we were moving along the digestive tract of some great monster. When the oars sunk into the slurry, ripples spread away from the point of contact. The ripples rebounded off each other and generated second-order patterns through their interference. Colors glimmered beyond the green. Were we moving at all? It was hard to be sure. We had no reference points whatsoever, and I doubted that anything in Glass's head was able to track our movement relative to Scythe or First Camp. I had a horrible vision of us trapped forever between these oozing walls, thinking we were rowing, but actually motionless.
"I see faces," Pinky said.
Under any circumstances, I felt sure that Glass would have been swift to contradict him, telling him that his brain was playing tricks on his conscious mind. Instead, she nodded.
"Yes, I see them as well. Momentary coherent forms, emerging and disappearing. Do you see them, Clavain?"
"Yes," I answered, stopping punting for a moment, as Pinky had done.
"It's only started in the last few moments, hasn't it? Something's been roused."
"The faces mean nothing to me,"
Glass said, "but Pinky might recognize them, if they relate to the citizens of First Camp."
"We aren't always good with human faces. You know how it is. Something about your lack of a decent pair of ears and a snout." But after a silence, he added, "I don't see anyone I remember, but they come and go so quickly it's hard to be sure. It's like seeing phantoms in a fire."
"It's possible that these faces are drawn from the memories of those who swam here, or who were absorbed, not necessarily people who ever visited Ararat."
Glass nodded peremptorily.
"Keep rowing. This is encouraging."
"I've never felt so encouraged." But Pinky sighed and resumed his half of the rowing, and so did I.
"Only human form so far," I commented.
"That we recognize,"
Glass said. "If there were alien faces in those patterns, our visual systems might have missed them completely. Assuming aliens even have faces,
But I think it likely the biomass is drawing on information patterns that it understands to be pertinent to us, as humans, rather than the vast collective memory of other visitors who were here thousands or even millions of years ago. Again, I'm inclined to see it as an encouraging overture.
I forced a smile, hoping it would lift my spirits. I'd hate to see your idea of discouraging. We continued down the channel, which had now become a squeezing corridor of faces, constantly forming and dissipating in the slurry. They were there and gone in much less than a second, just long enough for the eye to snag the proportions and know that it was detecting something meaningful. The faces were green masks, blank-eyed forms with a strange constancy of expression, like vaguely amused theatre-goers roused from distracted trains of thought by our passage. Ripples, rippling into ripples, become faces, dissolving back into randomness, over and over again. I recognized none of them, and saw nothing that looked like my own face. Glass lunged for the gas harpoon. She grabbed it double-handed and swung it back to aim at the disturbed water we had already passed through. Her hands were shaking, jerking the barbed barrel. I reached out and steadied the harpoon. What?
One of those things. I saw it for a second, behind us, in the channel. Just its head, but a clearer view. It's humanoid. Human-derived, I should say.
It's not there now.
It was,
Glass said. We kept rowing, but slowly, with nearly all our focus directed back along the green shadowed channel. The torrent of faces had eased, seemingly detecting our nervousness. Glass's hands were still shaking. It was not apprehension in her case, but a neuromuscular consequence of whatever was happening in her brain. Gently, I took the harpoon gun from her while Pinky managed both oars, dipping them languidly into the water rather than levering them against the banks. Somewhere in the gaps in our records, I said quietly, someone must have come here and adapted to the ocean, or been forced to adapt. Whatever the case, we're the newcomers now. Those swimmers would be dead unless they'd found some equilibrium with the sea and the jugglers, some way of life that allows them to coexist with the nodes. I smiled. Out of all this chaos and darkness, something new. Speciation, adaptation, biogenesis. Life always finds a way. Until it doesn't, and there's nothing left to mourn it but decaying cell cultures. Adaptation's all well and good, but unless you've got something to fight the wolves with, you've just found a slower, quieter way of becoming extinct. You said they don't touch, Juggler warns. Perhaps that's our solution. Merge with the oceans and wait until the wolves have gone.
And while we're at it,
Glass said, sounding like Lady Arik for a moment,
we can de-evolve spines and central nervous systems as well.
Maybe we should wait until we've met these people before we pass judgment on their choices. Now might be your chance, Pinky commented. The swimmer was emerging from the water again, perhaps 15 meters behind us. A head rose above the green, then a widening neck, then the shoulders and sternum of a muscular, broad-chested torso. I couldn't tell if the swimmer was treading water or standing on some extension of the biomass beneath the surface, only that it seemed confident of its posture. Glass had been right when she spoke of human gene stocks. Of that, I had no doubt. Compared to some of the wilder strains of people that had existed in the Rust Belt, or out among the Skyjacks or Ultras, its adaptations were almost unremarkable. It had a flattened, seal-like face, with slitted nasal openings, and wide, forward-facing eyes that were clearly well-evolved for light-gathering underwater. Whiskers fanned out around the nose and mouth, a useful sensory augmentation in dark or confined spaces. The creature had external ears, but they were vestigial affairs and folded tightly to the skull, which was covered in a dark, glistening integument that I imagined must have very efficient thermal properties. The creature had a mane of green-stained hair, fanning down over the shoulders, and what I first took to be oddments of scrap contamination caught in the hair were in fact ornaments or trinkets, deliberately braided in. The skin glimmered here and there with paler, almost luminous patches of gold and green. Only the upper third of the creature was so far visible, but I could see nothing of clothing. All this I took in within a second of Pinky's words, adding these observations to the impressions already gained with our earlier encounters. We had already seen that the creatures possessed tools, and the desire to trap us, so my assumption was that this swimmer also had hostile intent. "Go back!" I shouted, jabbing the barrel of the harpoon gun in what I hoped was a sufficiently unambiguous fashion, regardless of which spoken languages the creature did or did not comprehend. A moan came from the swinger.
"No,"
it bellowed on a long, deep, falling note.
"No, no, go, no, go, no, go."
Unless my brain was filling in meaning where none existed, I felt that the utterance had been quite clear enough. Our tongue might not have been the one preferred by the creature, but it knew it well enough to issue a directive. "Not your decision to make, I'm afraid." I made another lunge with the harpoon gun. "Leave us alone, friend, and we'll leave you alone. Our business is not your business."
"Shoot it," Glass said.
Two barbs remained in the gun, one ready to be fired, and the other still stowed in the stock. I considered a warning shot, firing above the creature, but if that did not have the desired effect, and the creature made a lunge, I would not have time to load the third barb.
"Go," I shouted. "You understand, go. Go, or I'll hurt you. Don't make me do this."
"No, go, not swim. Bad time."
Glass turned on the motor, aiming its blast at the creature. It howled as the hot air lashed its face, then drew its left arm from the water, using a large webbed hand to shield its eyes. The boat accelerated away from the swimmer, sluggishly at first, then with gathering momentum. The swimmer's other arm came out of the water, and it had something in it. It was a sort of clawed grapnel on a line, and the creature swung it in widening, quickening arcs, letting out the line a little at a time, all in the fingers of one hand. I fired, but I still could not bring myself to aim directly for the creature. I knew it to be intelligent, and on some level I understood that its injunction had been as much warning as threat, and perhaps a warning that we would have been wise to heed. But we had come too far, and overcome too much to be deterred now. The shot was aimed at the swinging grapnel, not the creature's hand, but the effect was not very different. The barb collected the grapnel and its line, tangling with them, and in so doing ripped the line from the creature's grip, taking some portion of flesh with it. The creature bellowed, the tips of its fingers bloodied, and the webbing between those fingers lacerated and flapping loose. I released the barb's line. The creature was still looking at us, holding its wounded hand by the wrist even as it sank back into the water. Slowly, the curving corridor of green sealed it from sight, almost like a curtain closing, and we were alone again.